You're listening to The Critical Point on Aerogel.org. I'm your host, Steven Steiner. It's my pleasure today to be sitting down with Mr. Alex Capisalatro, who I met when he was just a junior in high school, I believe it was. I was in my second year of graduate school at MIT. Alex contacted me because he was interested in making aerogels, and so I showed him the ropes on how to build a supercritical dryer and a little bit about how to make gels, and he proceeded to go ahead and make aerogels of his very own and has since then gone on to work with a number of impressive aerogel scientists. Alex, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here today.
So, Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and what got you interested in aerogels?
Sure. So I'm from Brewster, New York, which is a suburb about an hour and a half north of Manhattan. And it was my junior year of high school, as Stevie said, when I first sort of saw a picture of an aerogel and just thought it looked really, really cool. And so the beginning of my, I'd say, chemistry career was with an asphyxiation of trying to make this solid smoke, this aerogel, which seemed so elusive to me. So in the beginning, it was a really tough struggle. Being in high school and trying to figure out how to go about making this, I really didn't have an on-site mentor. So what I did was I searched online to try to find any and every expert that works with aerogel. And this led me to people like Nicholas Leventis, who at the time was with the Glenn Research Center, Peter Tsu, who is over at the Jet Propulsion Lab, and of course Steven Steiner, who I found his website, Zero Gravity. What was the actual website?
Yeah, Zero G Aerogel. About our undergrad project, right?
Yeah. And I saw that he was at MIT, and I thought that's only, you know, three and a half hours from home. Why not drive up and meet him?
So at the time, I remember we talked about building supercritical dryer, and then you actually went and did this. And this is actually very similar to the one that we have on aerogel.org. It ended up looking pretty similar to the model that we later posted on aerogel.org. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? How was that experience?
So before I met Stevie, I had gotten so far as to make some very, very basic sol gels and had absolutely no idea how to go about drying them. And I had no idea what a supercritical solvent exchange was or, you know, extraction, any of that. So I met Stevie, and he showed me his process and his home-built, you know, manuclave, you called it.
That's right, yeah.
And I went home, and with his help, I started to try to piece together what I needed to build this. I was lucky enough to get a $500 grant from my high school to help pay for the parts, and found a local welder, and in a matter of weeks, I was able to get this thing built.
Would you say it was, was it hard? Was it challenging? Was it manageable? I mean, where would you put it on the difficulty scale of actually doing it?
I'd say the difficulty for a high school junior really wasn't that high, meaning anyone who's beyond a high school level can definitely do this. You need to be careful and safe, make sure it's all welded perfectly, make sure you have very high strength materials. You know, you don't want to cut, you know, with some weak aluminum if you're trying to build a supercritical dryer.
Yeah, you want to stick to the alloys, yeah, that are, you know, stainless steel alloys, 304, 316.
Right.
Make sure you have a person who knows how to weld stainless steel, do it, yeah.
But otherwise, it's all off-the-shelf parts. All I did was I assembled it, brought it to the welder, got everything welded, went to a welding company to get some CO2, and, you know, next thing I knew, I was starting to make these.
So what'd you do with them?
Well, in the beginning, I was having a hard time trying to figure out what to do that would be unique, creative, and interesting. And as a high school project and being a type 1 diabetic, I decided it would be really cool to try to make a passive insulating material for storing insulin, which is a polypeptide protein that diabetics have to inject, and it needs to stay cold. Now, at the time, Hurricane Katrina had just recently happened, and basically, diabetics who didn't have electricity couldn't refrigerate their insulin,
sure,
and therefore their insulin was going bad and it was becoming lethal. So the idea was, can we make a passive insulator for insulin?
That's actually a really good application for aerogels, is what we call passive thermal management systems. So it's active thermal management, like a refrigerator, requires a pump, energy, and it's bulky and heavy. So having like a portable refrigerator with you is not the easiest thing to do, but having something that's a super insulator and keeps your insulin cold for long periods of time, that's something that's actually very appealing for a lot of applications.
Right.
So then, so you made a science project out of this.
Right, but one of the big obstacles of this project was I needed to make an aerogel big enough to sit around this bottle, which wouldn't actually fit in my supercritical dryer. Besides that, the material itself is very weak, and when it starts to break down, it's no longer a very good insulator.
That's right, yeah.
And so this is when I started collaborating with Nicholas Leventis, who had transferred from the Glenn Research Center back to the University of Missouri, who had figured out a way to make very, very mechanically robust aerogels.
We call these X-aerogels now.
Right, and this was the beginning of a collaboration that lasted many years, and we actually published, I think, 3 times now together.
So X-aerogels, because they're mechanically strong, they start off as gels, similar to how you make a silica aerogel, and then you infiltrate them with a polymer that creates a conformal coating over the gel skeleton, and then that enhances the mechanical strength, like reinforces it, kind of like the marshmallows in a Rice Krispie treat, reinforces the particles that can make up the skeleton mechanically. And so then actually you can evaporate the liquid from the gel slowly, usually, and usually something like pentane and not acetone, but you evaporate the liquid from the pores of the gel and it doesn't collapse or it doesn't sort of shatter the way that a normal gel would. Is that
exactly
right?
But what you need to realize is at the time I was doing this on a shoestring budget in my high school, and just getting, you know, solvents like hexane, pentane, acetonitrile, which I needed for this work, was fairly costly.
Yeah.
So it was at this time that I met Deborah Rollison, who was at the Naval Research Lab. And for the last couple of months that I was in high school, I actually had the Naval Research Lab funding my work. So they would send me up any chemical I needed, and I was doing that work out of my high school without having to pay a dime.
That's a pretty good deal.
Absolutely. And
so what I like about that is that it's in the spirit of making things possible and being creative. So we actually have an article under the Make section, which is talks about how to afford this and how to go about getting the resources you need if you don't have them already. And so this is, you know, maybe not reproducible, but it's a good example of when you have a committed mind that you can go out and find the right people to work with you and to help you get where you need to go. So tell us then, so you went to ICEF, the International Science and Engineering Fair, with this. How'd you do there?
I did. So I ended up taking 3rd place there internationally for, I think I was in the engineering category.
Oh, great.
And so that was based on the mechanically robust aerogel that was dried ambiently and, you know, encompassed all of these different facets of the actual project. And that work, I actually ended up presenting at a conference in France, one of the International Sol-Gel Society conferences, and I won the Best Poster Award for that work. So, and we published that in the Journal of Noncrystalline Solids.
As a high school student.
As a high school student.
So it just goes to show you do not need to be a PhD in chemistry or material science to do this kind of stuff. So then you worked with Deborah Rollison. You actually went to the Naval Research Lab and worked with her, isn't that right?
Right. So part of the agreement for them to fund my work was I would leave high school at a certain point and come down and work for them. So I spent about 6 months down there, and I worked on a number of projects. Everything from biosensor work with sol gels to some carbon battery type materials. I was working on one project that was interesting. It was a photon attenuation project where I was basically trying to stop X-rays using aerogels with embedded heavy metals.
It's like freeze the photon in its path.
Right, and just cause points of intersection where the photons basically intersect, block, and scattered. Are not able to get through.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah.
So then after you worked with Deborah, you ended up at UCLA, isn't that right?
Right. So I worked with Deborah the summer before I started college. And when I started college, it was out in Los Angeles at UCLA. And I immediately started working with Professor Bruce Dunn. Now, I need to definitely thank him for the work that I ended up doing throughout high school. I forgot to mention this. I met him at a conference a year before I graduated high school. And so during that year, I was able to make my samples, but I was not able to characterize them. Well, thanks to him and his research group, I was mailing my samples across the country. They would characterize them, everything from SEM, TEM, BET, surface area, you know, pore symmetry, all that good stuff. And they would send me back the results. So I had been collaborating with them for about a year before I went there and joined the group itself.
That's awesome, because I can attest to this when I was in high school and doing aerogel stuff. You know, characterizing the aerogels was really hard. I didn't have access to SEM or TEM, and so, you know, the characterizations I did were all sort of at the bulk level, measuring their density and building a device to kind of measure their transparency. But when it came to actually understanding the important things, the nanostructure and the microstructure, things that scientists and universities can do, that was sort of out of the scope of what I was able to do. So that's actually really great that you managed to align that so early. So what kind of work did you do with Bruce Dunn then? Did you worked in his lab and actually made materials with him?
Yeah, so one of the main projects I worked on was making cerium zirconium fuel cells, which are all sol gel
oxide, cerium zirconium oxide. Yeah, okay.
So they were, you know, aerogel based, and, you know, we were basically working on a collaboration with the Jet Propulsion Lab on this project. And it was a very interesting project because the materials themselves were structured both on the nano level and the macroscopic level. We were using these polystyrene beads and making these sort of inverse opal structures, which enabled very fast gas diffusion while still having the nanostructure, which allowed for very specific catalytic properties.
So that is a material that has sort of micron size or micron range pores with struts that were inherently nanoporous.
Right.
So for those of you out there who aren't aware, one of the Guinness Book of World Records properties that most aerogels have is they have the slowest diffusion time for gases passing through them of almost any material. And so we're in applications where you actually want gases to interface with the material that the aerogel is composed of, you need to somehow get around that. It actually becomes a problem. So what Alex just explained, having this kind of hierarchical pore structure, having large micron diameter pores that act like highways for the gas molecules to run through and then seep into these nanopores to react with the surface is actually a really clever idea. So then after you worked with Bruce, who'd you work with next?
So I worked with Bruce during my academic year, but for the summer I really wanted to just go see a new lab, see a new place, and there really is no one in the field higher up than Jeffrey Brinker.
See Jeffrey Brinker, the father of modern sol-gel science
the book
and technology.
Wrote the book.
Literally wrote the book, Sol-Gel Science and Technology.
Yeah. So I just called him up, told him what I'd been doing, what I wanted to do, and he invited me to his lab for the summer.
So that's down in Sandia National Laboratory?
Right. He's got a joint position with Sandia National Labs in New Mexico and the University of New Mexico, both in Albuquerque. Actually, his main lab is at an intersection of the two, a lab called the AML, the Advanced Materials Laboratory, and it really is funded by both departments.
So what kind of work did you do with him, and what was it like working for him?
Well, working with him was really a wonderful experience. The man is brilliant, and just the scope of his research, he's got, I want to say, 20 to 30 graduate students that are working everywhere from nanoparticle work to, you know, biomaterials to, you know, still sol-gel work. And what I was working on was cell encapsulation in very thin film sol-gel materials. And the idea being they had theorized that you could keep cells alive inside of a porous sol-gel material virtually indefinitely. The thing is, that's a very bold statement. So proving it is a very difficult task, but also figuring out how you can utilize this for an advantage is a very difficult task.
So, for example, an application of this might be, let's take healthy pancreatic cells from a donor and we encapsulate them into some kind of an aerogel or sol-gel type encapsulation and then implant them into, for example, a type 1 diabetic where those cells can be active and receive nutrients through the pores of the walls of that sol-gel material.
So what Stevie's explaining right here is the basis of a company that I'd help work with a man by the name of Edward Pope, who was the first to actually encapsulate cells in a sol-gel material. Now, he's right in that this is similar in concept, the difference being these materials were going to be implanted into a wet environment.
Okay.
And so you didn't have to worry about drying concerns, and cells naturally live inside the body, so being that they're already inside a sol-gel that's then inside the body doesn't put very harsh environment around the cells.
And most importantly, the immune system of the recipient can't attack the donor cells, which would happen if you just implanted them directly. Is that right?
Exactly. That's the theory. Unfortunately, it still hasn't been proven whether or not this can absolutely work. But what we were doing with Jeff Brinker was putting cells into a thin film sol-gel material that was structured on a mesoscopic level that was then left in a dry environment. And so the idea was to prove that you could keep cells alive in a dry environment for a very long period of time.
Oh, that's cool.
And so this is really big for Sandia, who's working on different biosensor type applications, where you want to have sensors based on a cell's response to a stimulus that's not going to be in a wet environment.
Oh, that's cool. So after that, you went back to UCLA for your sophomore year of college, right?
Right, and this was an interesting time. I'd spent so much time working in the Sol-Gel field that I thought I didn't want to pigeonhole myself. I looked around at a few different labs, and I was initially going to work for Fraser Stoddart, who's known as the inventor of the mechanical bond. Basically, imagine a ring molecule and another ring molecule interlocking. There's no chemical bond here, but they're mechanically stuck together. And because of this, you can create some very, very interesting devices.
In fact, I think I remember an exam question from my second semester of organic chemistry where we actually had to talk about how you would take that structure apart and put it back together, right, like with organic chemistry.
And these were called catenanes and rotaxanes, and they're very interesting.
And I got the exam question wrong.
But of course, being the man that he is, Fraser Stoddart was in the middle of a move. And instead of going with him to Northwestern, where he is now, he put me in touch with a very good friend of his, Professor Omar Yagi, who's in the chemistry department at UCLA. And so I spent my year working in Professor Omar Yagi's lab, who's known as the inventor of MOF, Metal Organic Frameworks.
So what's a MOF? Tell us about MOFs.
So MOFs have surpassed aerogels in terms of high surface area and porosity in a material. They're basically very simple, orderly crystalline materials that have extremely, extremely high surface areas.
So what kinds of pore sizes do they have compared to aerogels?
So the pore sizes are much, much smaller than aerogels, which make them ideal for certain scenarios, such as storing hydrogen, but not so good in terms of, you know, drug delivery, which is what aerogels are possibly used for.
So as I understand it, MOFs kind of top out at 2 nanometers, sort of the largest pore size. Is that right?
Exactly, and usually even smaller than that.
Okay, yeah, generally smaller. And aerogels, on the other hand, have an average pore size usually between 5 and 20 nanometers, for example.
Exactly. So I joined the lab coming in as the engineer of the group. These were all chemists, and I was the only engineering student in the group. And the idea was to take my experience working with porous materials, these aerogel materials, on a very applied side, which was, you know, fuel cells and biosensors, and to figure out how can we work with MOFs in such a way.
So when you compare a MOF to an aerogel, like if you were to hold MOF in your hand, how is it similar, how is it dissimilar from a typical silica aerogel, for example?
And this is the very question we couldn't answer because I was trying to figure out how to even get to that stage. When MOFs are made, they're always made in powders. It's very, very difficult to even make them as a single crystalline structure, let alone as a bulk material. Whereas an aerogel is a bulk material that you can hold, it's a monolith, MOFs always, always come in powder forms. So what I was working on was pressing them into pellets and different materials so we could then actually work with them. Unfortunately, it's a lot tougher than you would think to make powder MOFs into a workable, solid monolith.
So they may have surpassed aerogels as far as surface area and in terms of their tiny, what we call microporosity, you know, sub-2-nanometer pores, but they're not perfect materials by any means.
Right.
But they're interesting. They have applications in catalysis, like you said, hydrogen storage, and Alex is going to be writing an article for us on MOFs in the very near future, so you'll be able to see that under the Learn section here on aerogel.org. So then after Yagi, I think you ended up working with some other folks, isn't that right?
Exactly. So the summer after Yagi, I was trying to figure out what would be a good direction to take my career. I clearly at this point had worked with a lot of different materials in terms of, you know, porous materials and sensors and, you know, even the fuel cell stuff, but I hadn't worked at all in the electronic area, which very, very much interests me. So semiconductors, transistors, this type of work. And I was lucky enough to get a position working for George Whitesides at Harvard, and I was working on making some very, very simple nanostructures, which we were trying to then use to make devices like transistors.
So totally different types of stuff from Sol-Gel, kinds of nanofabrication, rational designs, and patterning analogous more to semiconductors than to self-assembly kinds of things that happen in Sol-Gel, right?
It is, except there are more parallels than you can imagine. I mean, being a multidisciplined student means I pulled different resources I had learned through working with Sol-Gel materials into this group that I otherwise would not have known. So while it was a very, very different lab and very different materials, there were a lot of similarities in the work that I was doing.
And I think that's a really good example of why aerogels are a really awesome thing to get started with, you know, even as a high school student, because even if you don't end up doing aerogels as, you know, what you end up studying in graduate school or going to the workplace working with. It gives you a lot of experience, a lot of different challenging and interesting topics that will equip you to do a lot of cool stuff later on, right?
Exactly.
So what are you doing now? You're a senior at UCLA.
Right.
And you're getting ready to go and go off to your next big adventure. So what's the future of the Kappa Cilantro trajectory here?
Well, I'd say I'm lucky in the regard that I have many open doors and many possibilities. Right now I'm looking into different graduate programs, but in addition I have a very entrepreneurial drive, and I'm very interested in seeing how we can take this research going on in the laboratory and actually move it out to industry, actually affect society in a positive way. So right now I'm working on a small company that's trying to use technology that did originate in university settings and push it out into society. And I'm right now sort of deciding which path to take. Am I going to jump directly into the entrepreneurial path, or am I going to stick with the research level graduate work? And I couldn't tell you at the moment.
Well, I think those are all great options, and it sounds like you have a good set of dilemmas in front of you right now. Alex Kappa Cilantro, inspired by aerogel, making a difference. It's been a pleasure having you on The Critical Point.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Be sure to keep us up to date of your future activities, and if you have any advice for anyone out there in parting, what would you say?
There are absolutely no limits to what you can do. In the beginning, I was told no by more people than I care to remember. I wanted to go and get some experience in a research lab in high school. I was told no by so many professors. I wanted to go and make an aerogel. In the beginning, I was told no by so many people. And yet it's the generosity of people like Steven Steiner and Nicholas Leventis and Jeffrey Brinker that have really allowed me to do what I've done. And so my advice to you is to seek out those people that will inspire you and motivate you and open doors for you. And when people close doors, figure out a way to get around it, because there is no limit.
For aerogel.org, I'm Steven Steiner, reminding you that aerogel's not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved. Thanks for listening.